so much. Good evening, everyone. Good evening. Good evening. Our goal is to be punctual. I was alerted to the fact that we have, indeed, almost half a dozen former Rosenbach lecturers here this evening. I'm not going to ask those individuals to stand up, but I would like to shout out a particularly warm welcome to Anthony Grafton, who is here this evening and who is a former Rosenbach lecturer. So welcome, Tony Grafton. Good evening and welcome to the third and final lecture of the 2014 ASW Rosenbach Lectures in Bibliography. I think that you would agree that thus far our lecturer and her lectures have been superb thus far. I would be remiss if I didn't remind you that at 12:57 this afternoon, spring arrived officially, although it doesn't feel very springy today. I would also be remiss if I did not take a moment to thank several people who have been instrumental in making this year's lectures the success that they are. First, I would like to thank Roger Chatier and Peter Sallybras for their introductions to lectures 1 and 2, respectively. I would like to thank Lloyd Frank, the invisible sound man who is recording Anne's lectures for later podcast. I would also like to thank Alita Arthurs, the library's events coordinator, who organized Monday's reception and arranged our speakers' travel and accommodation. And finally, I would like to thank ASW Rosenbach for having the foresight to fund these lectures at the University of Pennsylvania. Finally, I'd like to thank you, I should say, and ultimately and finally, I would like to thank you, the audience, for coming and being such active auditors. I would like to remind you that you should mark your calendars for the 2015 Rosenbach Lectures. Bill Zachs will be our guest lecturer, and the dates of the lectures are March 16, 17, and 19, 2015. I also have something hot off the press. I'm also pleased to announce that Matt Kirschenbaum, associate professor in the Department of English at the University of Maryland and associate director of the Maryland Institute for Technology in the Humanities, has agreed to give the 2017 Rosenbach Lectures. Before I introduce my colleague, Lynn Farrington, who will introduce our speaker tonight, I want to take a brief moment to say that, like many of you, I too have thoroughly enjoyed reading Anne's book, Too Much to Know. In particular, my favorite chapter is, alas, like tonight's lecture, the last one, Impact of Early Printed Reference Books. Since I started lingering in libraries as a teenager, there was no more wonderful locus in my local library than the reference collection. It was my gateway to the wider world of knowledge. It was a place of reverie and discovery. As an undergraduate and graduate student, the reference stacks were essential to undergirding and providing the bibliographic documentation for my research. After receiving my library degree, I was, to use the antique phrase, a humanities and social sciences reference librarian in a large academic research library. To meet our patrons' needs, ranging from undergraduates to senior scholars, I was required to learn the location of 50,000 reference works and master their purpose in research so that I could answer the patron's question, whether it was biographical, verifying a quote, a citation, or the location of a manuscript or archive. When I started in 1990, Microsoft Windows didn't exist. In 1992, we installed our first quirky CD-ROM workstations. In 1995, we were awed by the World Wide Web. For many librarians, it was an age of innocence, until the appearance of Google and paradise came to an end. For the past 20 years, reference departments, the staff and their collections, have been in retreat, if not in peril, especially in the age of Amazon, Wikipedia, Bing, Google search, etc. Of course, it's not all doom and gloom, but reference departments are adrift in the online era, as they are desperately trying to reinvent themselves as information resource centers. Of course, there remain essential questions that only humans seem qualified to answer, like, where is the bathroom? In her epilogue, Anne grapples with some of the big issues and rightly explicates both the value of printed reference works and their limitations, and likewise praises the internet and our ability to access online databases, and at the same time, she acknowledges the limits of technology. The purpose of a reference work is to cite, identify, define, digest, verify the world of fact, real or imagined, within the Republic of Letters, broadly defined. For the past 500 years, referent works have proven to be essential to the humanist project, as Anne amply demonstrates. As we reduce our world of expression to a few thumbtaps on a miniature screen, or witness cable news anchors and pundits fudge fact or traffic in mendacity dressed as truth, we need the resources to fact checks, to do fact checking, verify, and get it right. I thank Anne Blair for recognizing the importance of reference works, both as the product of scholarship and validating this importance in our historical resource, as a historical resource, and moreover, demonstrating the value of reference works in her own scrupulous research. Thank you, Anne. I would now like to introduce my colleague, Lynn Farrington, curator of printed books, who will introduce our speaker this evening.
I've been given a Herculean task tonight, that is the task of following not just one, but two excellent introductions given earlier this week by Roger Chartier and Peter Stalybras, whom a student once called the Maurice Chevalier and John Cleese of book history. First, given the subject matter of this year's Rosenbach Lectures, Hidden Hands, Amanuensis and Authorship in Early Modern Europe, I'd like to take a moment to thank publicly all the, perhaps not so hidden, but truly vital helpers that we in the Kislak Center for Special Collections depend on every day to provide the services that our patrons have come to expect. These helpers are the many undergraduates, graduate students, and recent graduates who work with us on a daily basis, paging and reshelving the books and manuscripts used by patrons in the reading room, and by the many classes that meet up here every week during the academic year, manning multiple desks where they meet the newly arrived patrons, answer the phone, and oversee the reading room, and working on special projects, whether for the Schoenberg Institute for Manuscript Studies, the Special Collections Processing Center, or the Rare Book and Manuscript Library. Many helpers have passed through special collections during the past 20 years, years that I myself have spent at Penn. And no matter what they have gone on to do with their lives, I know we truly appreciate the contributions they have made to this community of scholars while they have been here, and hope that they too benefited from the time they spent among us and the collections. They are our unsung heroes, and we remain grateful to them. It is with great pleasure that I introduce tonight's speaker, Professor Anne Blair, for the third and final ASW Rosenbach Lecture in Bibliography for 2014. Professor Blair, for those of you who were not here previously, is a Henry Charles Lea Professor of History at Harvard, where she also serves as the Director of Undergraduate Studies. She was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship in 2002 and elected to the American Philosophical Society in 2009. Her most recent book, Too Much to Know, Managing Scholarly Information Before the Modern Age, was published by Yale in 2010. What I would like to focus on tonight is the Lea connection. I note this first because Professor Blair holds a Henry Charles Lea Chair in History at Harvard, while Penn holds Lea's own scholarly library in the lovely room just behind us. More importantly, I would like to consider Lea's own working methods in gathering, evaluating, and using information in writing his most important works, A History of the Inquisition in the Middle Ages, first published in 1887, and A History of the Inquisition of Spain, published first in 1906 and 1907. Lea's methods reflect back on many of the themes raised in the first two lectures. Henry Charles Lea was essentially an armchair scholar. Unlike traveling scholars who visit numerous libraries in search of the books and manuscripts required by their work, Lea preferred to work from the comfort of his own home. He was also what we now refer to as an independent scholar, unaffiliated with any institution of higher learning. Instead of traveling to collections, he asked the collections to travel to him, whether by means of acquisition, and he amassed what is clearly a major scholarly library of books and manuscripts on the Inquisition, now here at Penn, or by borrowing and having copied manuscripts belonging to other, primarily European, libraries and archives. In one of his letters, he refers to the Italian and Spanish manuscripts being sent to him from the Bodleian Library, as well as from the Royal Libraries of Copenhagen and Munich. Good luck to anyone who makes a request like that today. Of course, Lea duly returned the manuscripts when the copying was done. These copies and others now comprise the 56 boxes of Manuscript Collection 729, the Henry Charles Lea Research Collection on the Inquisition. Because most of the drafts and revisions of Lea's historical writings have been preserved, we know that his working method was to take extensive notes on his readings from published and manuscript sources. He used these notes to compose the drafts of his books, crossing out items as he used them. He would then write out by hand the final version of the work for the use of the compositor. So, Lea clearly used amanuensis for some tasks, that is, copying out manuscripts from other libraries and archives, but not for others, that is, making notes, composing his text, and providing the printer with a clean copy. In situations where European institutions would not send their important manuscripts across the Atlantic, Lea hired local amanuenses to do the copying for him. He admits in a letter that this is a very unsatisfactory method of working, even when the person employed is trained to this kind of historical research. But I have been obliged to content myself with it in some of the Italian archives, as in those of Naples, Florence, and Venice. Another library where this became a necessity was that of Trinity College Dublin, whose board refused to lend Lea any of their Inquisition manuscripts. The librarian wrote Lea with the bad news and told Lea that he would try to find some competent person to perform the preliminary task of describing for you the contents of some of the volumes. This plan worked, sort of. Lea corresponded in 1888 with Alice Croker of the Irish Association for Promoting the Training and Employment of Women in reference to copying manuscripts related to the Inquisition in the Library of Trinity College Dublin. Lea sent to Miss Croker a list of the items to be copied in very specific instructions. Here I quote Lea, "Write on both sides of the paper. When a new folio of the original is reached, always indicate it on the margin of the copy. Each document to be on a separate leaf or sheet of paper so that I can handle them independently of each other. On each one, note the volume and press mark which it bears in the library and the initial folio so that it can be referred to. In transcribing indexes of subsequent volumes, state the length or number of pages in folio of each document. Endeavor to make out the contractions of the original and write them out in full when you feel sure of them." He's pretty thorough, much like Erasmus must have been. But it wasn't all smooth sailing. Later, Lea wrote to Crocker, "The young lady employed evidently has as yet little familiarity with old writing, and especially with the contractions, which are the most troublesome part of it. But I hope that she will soon grow accustomed to them, and doubtless there are persons connected with the library who will good-naturedly aid her at first to solve difficulties. If she can do what I require, I will provide a job extending over a considerable time, and it will be worth her while to train a little for it. I have located the image of a page that is part of this Inquisition manuscript collection on the Trinity College Dublin Library website." Clearly, this young lady had a difficult task at hand, which is partly to blame for the delays Lea experienced in receiving his copies. But Alice Croker, responding to Lea, gives him another reason for the time delay, one that many of you who have worked in European libraries may well be familiar with. "I am sorry my girl has been so long in what I send, but the truth is the library of Trinity College is so cold, she can only work there for a short time each day." We, on the other hand, are lucky tonight, for we enjoy central heating as we listen to Professor Blair give her concluding Rosenbach lecture on authors and amanuenses.
Well, thank you very much for that splendid introduction. Every day I've been here, more treasures out of this library have sprung forth, thanks to Lynn and John and everyone. It's just been wonderful. Thank you. It's been just a treat to be part of your community, and I really look forward to your feedback tonight. So, tonight I'd like to start with an example, which will recapitulate some of the points I've tried to make so far, and will open onto my new focus this evening on the role of print in the public assignment of thanks criticism, and credit, including examples of how those public assignments involved misrepresentations resulting from the various motives of authors and publishers to maximize profit and honor, I will argue. So for some of this lecture, I will stray from amanuenses themselves to talk more broadly about why, in some cases, credit was given, withheld, or altered in print, and how helpers serve not only to take the blame for errors, as we've seen already, but also as spokespersons through whom the writer could speak without placing himself at risk. But first, my example, which comes from the life of Petrus Ramus, composed circa 1583 by Nicolas de Nancel, who had worked with Ramus for 20 years, first as his student, then as his colleague at the Collège de Presles in Paris, before moving on to his own medical career. In telling the story of Ramus's life, in gratitude for his deserving services to me and to the Republic of Letters, Nancel says, Nancel, of course, is also calling attention to his own accomplishments and contributions, and I am very pleased to be drawing on the 1975 edition and translation by Peter Charat of this text. Ramus, 1515 to 72, came to Paris penniless from the north of France and started off as a servant to a professor at the Collège de Navarre. He studied, as his duties allowed, devising various means of sleeping only a few hours, notably attaching a stone to a slow-burning cord, so that when the cord was burned out, the stone would clatter to the ground, waking him up. You should try that. 2 or 3 hours is what you get of sleep that way. When Ramus had completed his studies, he borrowed from his mother the fees needed to obtain the master's degree, because the teachers had to be paid off, a debt which he later easily repaid, as Nancel ascertained, he explains, from speaking with Ramus's mother and sister on this point. Ramus also, quote, rendered services and homage to well-born fellow students, and among them he impressed the future Cardinal of Lorraine, who remained an important patron and defender. Quote, although Ramus's condition was that of a servant, the Cardinal could see and admire in him the signs of a liberal mind and the marks of natural learning and nobility. So we see here the porousness of the social categories I talked about before the 18th century. Ramus is starting off as a servant, and thanks to his hard work and ambition, he ends up as professor at the Collège Royal, the future Collège de France. Early in his career, Ramus associated himself with two colleagues, Omer Talon of Beauvais, famous for the study of eloquence, here I'm quoting, and Barthélemy Alexandre from Champagne, who was a good Greek scholar. And as Nancel says, these three men provided complementary teaching, fraternal friendship, adopted a communal life, and shared the common fruits of their studies. There was one mind among them, one spirit, a common purse, and a common home. So here's one of these scholarly households of a kind we haven't quite seen yet, three men living together. Nancel explains that Ramus was the natural leader, since he was the more famous and more learned, and endowed with native dignity. He arranged the program of lecturing and teaching, which drew great crowds. Quote, for many years, there was no one skilled in the liberal arts in Paris who was not a product of Ramus's workshop, the Officina Rami. Nicolas de Nancel, sadly, I have to make do with a title page, I don't have an image of him, was 25 years younger than Ramus. In 1548, at age 9, he arrived at the Collège de Presles, and here's a little remnant thereof, in the 5th arrondissement, where Ramus had become principal. Nancel, too, was a bursar from a modest background. He spent 6 years there getting his degree, then stayed on as Ramus's assistant and as a teacher until 1568. Nancel performed tasks typical of the helpers I've described, taking notes, doing lots of copying, using his judgment in finding loci, even composing, working with haste to a printer's deadline. What we don't have is taking dictation or indexing. Nancel accompanied Ramus to class, where he stood next to him to hand him the books that he needed and tug on his coat if he made a silly mistake. Ramus had a terrible handwriting that only those accustomed to could read it, as Nancel was, of course, and we remember Erasmus saying the people nowadays can't read their own writing and they get their secretary to read it. Quote, when Ramus returned home from lecturing, he used to jot down in shorthand what he had lectured and commented on. After we, that is I, had copied out these notes in our own hand in a beautiful script, he kept them at home with the intention of publishing them. But they were held back for some reason and were lost tragically when Ramus's rooms were stormed by attackers who killed him during the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre. And part of Nancel's message is about all that work of his that was with Ramus and lost at that time. quote, where they are now, by whom they were plagiarized or stolen after the death of Ramus, together with many other works of his and of mine, I do not know. But if anyone publishes any of these after changing or suppressing the name of the authors, it will not be very difficult to detect the theft. So Nocel presumes that someone will try to monetize this theft and issues a warning that he'll come after them. There's no record of anyone coming forward, though. Maybe it wasn't as easy as Nocel thought for others to find value in an academic's papers. Then as now. Nocel bemoaned especially the loss of copies of Greek mathematical works that he had made in an elegant Greek script of his own devising modeled on printed characters. Quote, to make copies of moldy, worm-eaten manuscripts which had been sent to him on loan from the Vatican Library in Rome, the Library at Fontainebleau, from other sources. Ramus made use especially of my work, both day and night, at the great expense of my eyesight and to the detriment of my health. And I hear, I have yet to follow up, that there may be some of these Greek manuscripts at the University of Leiden. Ramus also gave Nocel tasks that required judgment, along with precise instructions, just as Bacon and others advised. When Ramus wanted to show in his commentaries that Virgil imitated Theocritus, quote, he made me listen to him attentively and learn Virgil by heart so that I should be able to make the comparison more readily and end up by easily recognizing Virgil and Theocritus, or vice versa. We ourselves have indicated every quotation from Theocritus or any imitation of him in the commentary with extensive citation of the Greek text. Ramus asked Nocel to write a grammar to fit to his specifications. Quote, he sketched in the first colors and the primitive structure and method of the work, and I helped him to arrange it in its proper place, material gathered together from various sources. I hunted out all over the place whatever would help make a complete survey of the art, often discussing with Ramus how best to arrange and present everything. Finally, I wrote it out all myself, corrected the proofs, and under the leadership and authorship of Ramus, offered it to the public in its present form. In other words, the work was published under Ramus' name, even though Nocel did all the research and the writing under Ramus' guidance. Nocel was not alone in the Officina Rami. As long as Omer Talon was around to run the house, I don't know what happened to Barthélemy Alexandre. No mention of him after that. First mention. Ramus lodged 12 boys for a fee. Quote, he must have made a certain sum of money from this. And he, quote, used to employ them principally as assistants to read and write for him, to lighten and help his own studies, or to read to him when he had trouble falling asleep. And one of these boys was elected each year as head boy, a post that Nocel had held in his day. But Nocel noted proudly that after he was invited to teach at Douai in 1562 for a brief time, Ramus treated him as an equal. He would, quote, come to see me or ask me to go see him in order to try out on me his ideas on a subject, whether written down or not, and mentioning possible objections, additions, and improvements. Ramus would also dine alone with Nocel at that point from time to time, as opposed to the group meals typical within the college. So over time, the line between helper and peer became blurred, just as Cousin wished it to be blurred, even if Erasmus didn't treat him as a friend as he'd like. And just as Caramuel reminded you in getting help, you could use servants as well as friends to alphabetize slips. But Nocel's account is not all rosy. Ramus was not easy to live with, and not just because he only took a bath once a year, which was probably typical, but we find this out. In public, quote, Ramus showed great courage, especially in putting up with insults and taking no notice of the calumnies and rivalries of his enemies and opponents. He was a very controversial guy. But among his own people, Ramus was brutal and, quote, quite frightening, becoming irate, beating boys beyond the norm. So we see another emotional cauldron like the one that was around Erasmus. As a result, Nocel explains he never dared speak to Ramus about some things, like why Ramus republished under his name the work on rhetoric of his friend and close colleague Omer Talon after the latter's death. Nocel also reveals the true origins of a work that in the opposite direction appeared under Talon's name, though it was written by Ramus. When attacked by Adrien Turneb, another professor at the Collège Royal, Ramus felt, quote, he was an antagonist with whom it would be glorious to fight. So Ramus wrote a reply in the space of 2 to 3 days, writing day and night, a brilliant reply in Nocel's view. Quote, with equal speed, I read it over, punctuated it, copied it out, delivered it to the printer, spending the night at Vichel's in order to speed on the work by day and by night. It came out more quickly than anyone could have hoped or expected. But Ramus published it under Talon's name, quote, so as not to appear to be departing from his steadfast forbearance. He allowed Talon all the credit for this penetrating piece of work. I am aware as I declare this that I am the sole survivor, for there were only three of us who were party to this matter. So Nocel rushed to prepare Ramus's publications for print, and as a result was privy to the inaccurate attributions. On the one hand, Ramus claimed credit for a work of Talon's after his death. On the other hand, he published under Talon's name a polemical work of his own in order to keep himself out of a direct dispute with a colleague. While Nancel concludes that everyone realized the true authorship of Ramus's rhetoric, that it was really Talon's, he reveals with some momentous solemnity the latter maneuver as a hitherto closely guarded secret. So these are just two examples among many of the wisdom of another piece of Stoddardiana, not just that authors don't make books, printers do, but I'm sorry I haven't been able to find this piece of it in his writing. Maybe it was only table talk, and I'd be grateful for help, that most books lie to you in some way. So, intellectual historians typically use books as source of information. Who wrote what, when, where, as published by whom, in what context? And certainly the trappings of the modern book as it had formed by 1530, with all the details in the title page, abundant paratext, offer a lot of clues about a text. And attending to those clues is, of course, our job, a vital contextual analysis for an intellectual historian, who might otherwise just be reading a great text in translation in a modern edition, which I equate with eating canned food, canned vegetables, right? You need to go back to the original copy to put the vitamins in. But book historians have increasingly shown how the claims made on title pages and in paratexts themselves need to be analyzed critically. Their purpose, after all, was not to provide accurate information for the use of historians, or even for the use of contemporaries, but to satisfy the many players, such as those we call author, publisher, printer for convenience, each with their different ambitions for the book, ambitions which include selling books, but also building reputation, advancing knowledge, settling scores. And it seems to be money and honor are the two crucial currencies in these calculations. We've heard a lot about the finances of print, how the printed book, unlike the manuscript, required risky speculative investment, which could only be recovered by selling enough copies. Latin books were not constrained geographically, but reached only a limited learned audience, so the trick there was to trade it far and wide, geographically. But few authors made much money from their books. Authors typically sought reputation, which could be monetized in the near term, and obviously Erasmus did very well at that, but which also appealed as a bid for life beyond death, as Horace had so eloquently articulated. Authors tended to care about honor and could engage in interesting maneuvers, as Ramus did, in order to maintain what they perceived as the honorable persona they needed above all else. And print offered a powerful means of acquiring reputation across time and space, but only if the work did them honor. We've seen how authors like Erasmus or Bullinger were very concerned to control the circulation of their manuscripts to prevent unauthorized editions. And while that was a real risk and a misadventure that did happen, Alexandre van Oudtgaarden also shows convincingly how in some cases Erasmus claimed that a work was unauthorized until it had received a favorable reception, at which point he would revise it and treat it as authoritative. Erasmus also adopted some genuinely unauthorized works too. So the thieving servant who caused an unauthorized work to be published was a plausible ploy, precisely because it did happen in some cases. And it was one way of managing the anxiety surrounding print, of floating a work to test the waters without putting at risk one's reputation. Another classic strategy for one's honor was to emphasize personal humility, lack of ambition, and invoke instead a group of people who'd requested publication, from students clamoring for the professor's course, to friends clamoring for a work of poetry to be circulated, or scholars in the Republic of Letters requesting a learned work. And this has been studied nicely. Literary scholars have focused on these tropes, and more generally, they've articulated the anxiety about print as the stigma of print, a term coined in 1951 by J.W. Sanders to explain the reluctance, especially by well-born poets and women, to publish their work in the 16th and early 17th centuries. So John Donne famously never published anything, and many women authors nothing either. Authors from these milieu felt it would sully their name to have it ferried to parts unknown on a commercial object, so the argument goes. More recently, the stigma of print has come under some scrutiny, and in particular from the work of Dan Traster, among others. Isn't this notion just born of our own expectation that any writer should seek to be printed? But in fact, for a courtier, maybe print didn't offer any particular advantages. Why should they want to get their stuff printed? In addition, the particular aversion to print seems limited rather to just to poetry. And in fact, some of these well-born authors, men and women, contributed to learned genres, even as they withheld their poetry. And in any case, Henry Woodhouse reminds us that manuscript circulation posed a similar risk of exposure, though on a lesser scale. So I wouldn't want to buy into Sanders' notion of stigma right away. But clearly, print causes anxiety. I'll return to that, but first I also want to make the point that print was alluring, too. Clearly, many people were eager to get their name in print. The hard way to do that is to write a book yourself. The difficult part, especially, The difficult part being especially convincing a publisher, then as now, to invest in printing it. So short of writing a book yourself and hopefully being on the title page, Front Matter was a place where other contributors than the author might be named. The practice of dedicating books to well-placed individuals or groups was premised on the expectation that seeing their name publicly associated with a good book, diffused in hundreds of copies around the world for all time, would motivate the dedicatees to make a gift to the author. The dedicatee was the most visible of the thank yous extended in a printed book, sometimes based on past patronage and sometimes, of course, forward-looking. And we know the stresses attendant on dedications, which were sometimes the object of a cancel. If the dedicatee had in the meantime fallen from favor and not that many copies had gone out, you could quickly call him back, put in a new dedication, and send it out again. So you wouldn't want to waste a dedication, in other words. Liminary odes were another opportunity to get into print, whether signed by full names or initials or pseudonyms, and in some cases, one suspects that the latter devices masked odes by the authors themselves, proclaiming the virtues of their own work. Control of the front matter was important to all parties who might use this opportunity to advance relationships which they hoped to benefit from. That would be printers or authors or others. So that control was the object of lawsuits. In, for example, a case I encountered in my work on Jean Bodin and the French translation of his Univers et Natura Theatrum, the French translator François de Fougerolles sued the printer for payment and for control of the front matter. Fougerolles was allowed the latter, he was awarded the control, but not the money. But he made the most of what he did get, and he turned the front matter into 27 pages of dedication, preface, and dozens of liminary odes. Erasmus's behavior also offers a fine example of the significance of liminary odes. When one of his helpers had composed an ode, which he wished to have included in Erasmus's publication in press, Erasmus seemed to acquiesce and gave the ode to the printer, Jos Bad, in Paris, in front of the young man, Omen de Dreux. But at the same time, unbeknownst to Omen, Erasmus also instructed the printer to omit the ode, mocking the young man. The special irony is that, in fact, Bade failed to omit the poem. But in the following edition, Erasmus wrote to Aldus and had it dropped. So not coincidentally, Erasmus was also convinced that Omen was one of those nasty amanuenses who had published an unauthorized translation of Lucian that Erasmus had dictated to him. But we know that Erasmus also wrongly suspected his amanuenses sometimes too. So I don't know actually, and I want to look at this, how many of Erasmus's helpers got odes in his works. I'm not sure a whole lot actually. But we do know that when Cousin published his celebratory pamphlet in 1553, he indulged in composing and gathering odes to his heart's content. So here are a couple of slides I showed last time of Cousin's own copy of this Iphigies Cognati et Erasmi, focused on an image of him working on a very egalitarian basis with Erasmus, where he has added in the margins and larded more odes, some from print and other places, presumably either as a scrapbook or toward a further edition, which never happened. So those are odes. Early printed books have many kinds of paratext, but acknowledgments are not one of them. A lovely article by Françoise Vaquet notes the first appearance of acknowledgments of the kind we have today in the late 19th century in scholarly journals, and she finds that they became near ubiquitous after World War II. But even without an acknowledgment section, print could be used as an agent of thanks. Some thank yous were designed to make the author look good, like the dedication, which highlighted connections to persons of high rank. Other thank yous enhance the status of those thanked. Here's a young person worthy of attention, specifically my son or nephew or student. And a third category of thank yous were designed to encourage future contributions by readers to the author's ongoing projects. Interestingly, Richard Osterhoff, who's finishing a terrific dissertation at Notre Dame on the circle of Lefebvre d'Étaples in early 16th century Paris, has pointed me to a few early colophon which thank contributors who would typically not be mentioned, let alone named, in later decades. So in the arithmetic, quote, our domestic Ioannis Gritanus eased the burden, who is skilled in the study of counting on the abacus and other mathematics. And in the De Sphaera of 1494, so here's the title page, and here's the colophon. We have, great things are achieved not by the forces or speeds of bodies, but by judgment, wisdom, and authority, and by the most diligent editing of Lucas Walter Conitiensis, I haven't found out where that is yet, Guillaume Gontier, Johannes Gritanus, and Petro Grisel, lovers of mathematics. There was much to help with in both books. Mathematical diagrams, these are not margins you could take notes in. They've been completely taken up. Tables, these are longitudes and latitudes. They're also ascensions of the zodiac. But interestingly, in later editions, the names of the people thanked have disappeared. So in this 1514 colophon of the De Sphaera, the colophon has the special line about, you know, great things come from a wisdom and judgment and not the forces or speeds of bodies, but the sense about the people is gone. Instead, though, Guillaume Gontier gets an ode to mathematics and music. So thanks disappear. It seems like this was an experimental phase, and they don't last long in the colophon. Thanks also appear tucked away in prefaces, partly because of the biases of my own research, and perhaps partly because of the nature of the genre. In other words, I'm saying I haven't looked in too many other genres yet. My examples come from reference works. Rudolf Goclenius, in just the third sentence of the Ad Lectorum of his Lexicon Philosophicum, this is another colophon, where you can see the concilio line, but no names. They just dropped it. So here's the Goclenius. And so from the preface, in just the third line, he notes that the work, quote, would have taken much longer without the industry and remarkable erudition of John Wirtius of Zurich, who copied the work and even corrected it, so that the students of philosophy should owe him singular gratitude. And the same Wirtius in turn composed the longest of the liminary odes in the book that celebrates Goclenius. So I've got the start, the front here, and then it goes the long page worth, and then the bottom, and he signs off. In 1611, I find Wirtz defended a Diaskepsis Logico-Physica de Forma under the presidency of Rudolf Zimmler in Zurich, and he's praised as a blossoming young man. So he was likely a student while working for Goclenius, a favorite student then, whom Goclenius brings out in print. Or Theodor Zwinger, in the preface to the third edition of the Theatrum Humanae Vitae, mentions two people, Basilius Lucius, my very dear cousin, whom he calls his sole helper. I think I have the quote. It's the top quote. Who he used for 3 years and more to copy with a faithful and delicate hand and to glue things which needed to be put together. And at the beginning of his preface, Zwinger also mentions another young relative, Johannes Luca Iselin, this is the second quote, his dearest stepson, for whom Zwinger outlined a method of study on his departure to study in France. So there, he just seems to be dropping the name to boast about his own method of study. Now, when it comes to gluing things, we know all about that from Aldrovandi and others. Gessner here is from the Zwinger Nachlass in Zurich. You can see a lot of slips of paper in the hand of Zwinger's stepfather, Konrad Lycosthenes, whose Ex Libris appears on this book. And then a few other notes, probably in Zwinger's own hand, which obviously have taken a turn for the worse. In another kind of reference book, the Polyantea, which is a florilegium collecting sententiae from various kinds of authors, we find, and I'll get back to this work in a sec, but we find here the printer, Colinus, in Cologne, thanking M. Petrus Linnaeus, skilled in both languages and a public professor of Latin here, who helped me in all these things. Similarly, in A Loci Comunes by Joseph Lange, we have one Johannes Filius, a very handsome young Frenchman, being thanked for making an index to other fables, emblems, and symbols, which remains separate, quote, because the heap of papers was great and time was too short to complete the work and integrate the index. So they kind of tacked it on at the end. We also find thanks that are anonymous. A late edition of the Calipino Dictionary acknowledged the help of a, quote, very strong young man who worked on the edition for 4 years. Another thanked a very skilled young man for drawing up an index. Anonymous thanks have sometimes been suspected of hiding the author's own work. For example, in his Thesaurus Linguae Latinae, the printer Robert Estienne thanked a certain friend of ours, quidam amicus noster, which Martin Furneaux suspects was a way of claiming that others had worked on what was really his work. Printers in particular likely preferred to make it seem like someone else did the work to deflect accusations of profit-seeking, which often hovered over them and might undermine the authority and success of the dictionary. So invoking the contributions of others in these ways also kind of created a claim of shared responsibility, reducing the risk of dishonor to the single author. Print was also used to thank contributors, past contributors, in order to encourage future contributions. As Karl Burmeister first showed, and Jasper von Hutten in History of Art at Harvard is studying in his dissertation, Sebastian Münster's Cosmographia Universalis, 1544, cataloged information. Do I not have that? Oh, I do. Good. Cataloged information about cities and countries throughout Europe and drew on a network of correspondence, especially within the Holy Roman Empire, from noble princes to city councils, from whom Münster, working from Basel, that armchair historian basically, requested information and financial contributions. Some paid up, others didn't. Apparently the city of Basel gave him nothing. But the king of Poland did pay quite handsomely and got himself two maps of Poland instead of just one. Illustrated works, of course, required many helpers who aren't usually acknowledged. But we have unusually lavish depiction of the people involved in producing the History of Plants of Leonard Fuchs, including the author himself in a full-length portrait. Of course, these are hand-colored images afterwards. And at the back of the book, the portrait of the author is right behind on the verso of the title page. And this depiction of the three people responsible for the images is at the back of the book. We see the person who's drawing from the plant on the left. On the right is the person who's transferring the drawing to the woodblock, and pride of place goes to the engraver himself. So one argument I'm thinking about is the reason to highlight these people in this unusual way partly to encourage them to work with you in the future? You know, Fuchs is a good employer, and he will bring you credit of an unusual kind. I have to include this one, even though it doesn't really fit. This is the illustrator himself, the Illuminista, who is crediting his helper, right, who's brought a hug and a tankard of mead when the going gets rough. So this is my only depiction of family help. That's the prerogative of the illustrator, of course, to have a freedom of choice on the theme. Moving in the same year, then, that Münster was working in Basel, another bulk compiler in Zurich was just getting started, and that's Conrad Gessner. His earliest large-scale work, and his only bestseller, honestly, is this Onomasticon, a dictionary of proper names, which appeared with the Calipino Dictionary of Non-Proper Names for multiple editions, 22 editions over 70 years. What's fascinating is the attribution of authorship, compiled in part by Gessner and in part by his friends. This "his friends" is dropped in later editions. But it's interesting that Gessner repeated it in 1545 in his Bibliotheca Universalis, a collection of bibliographical entries, including his own work. So under Conrad Gessner, because it's all alphabetized by first name, you have a list of what he made. And here he talks about his Onomasticon, and he talks about it was, here he says, digesta, or put into order, rather than congesta, which is compiled. So basically, in part through my own labor, in part through the help of friends. Of course, they're unspecified friends, and we don't know. Is this a ploy? I don't know. For Gessner, this did become a standard modus operandi of thanking people. His compiling was, of course, constantly dependent on the input of others. And so here we have the Gilbert Cousin entry under Gilbert, first name, where we have a long, very accurate entry in which Gessner thanks Cousin. He was Erasmus's amanuensis in Freiburg and Basel for almost 6 years. He served good letters by protecting remarkable authors from the injury of time, bringing them to print. And he has helped our endeavor, honestly, indicating many writings of learned men of our time in his letters and by sending an index of the Library of Erasmus. Cousin also sent Gessner a list of his own publications, which on the left survives in manuscript at the University of Basel and is identically reprinted later on in the Cousin article in the Bibliotheca Universalis. So obviously, Cousin did a lot of the work for him there. What surprises me, actually, it a little infirms my earlier theories, I would have thought he would have ripped this up, you know, and glued it in. But maybe Cousin made two copies. Cousin was a real stickler for not, so maybe he gave Cousin, you know, gave Gessner a copy and kept one for himself. Gessner, of course, is a bulk compiler on natural historical topics as well. And the Natural History of Birds, the preface actually ends with a list of the principal people who helped us most generously. So that is a clear advertisement. You know, you help me, you get credit. Of course, in thanking some people, Gessner is leaving out others. And we know Gessner employed amanuenses, despite complaining about his tight finances. In the Bibliotheca, Gessner explained, this is the preface, I do not deny that some arguments and chapters are longer than I would have liked. That's mostly due to the amanuenses I used. And in other cases, I would not have wanted to be more brief. So he's saying, if you think it's too long, it's their fault. Classic maneuver. And even in the year of his death, obviously it's an unexpected death of the plague in 1565, Gessner wrote to Zwinger asking for help in finding, quote, a young man moderately instructed in letters, a student of medicine, poor, modest, and good, whom I could employ to write. He could hear one or the other public lecture and could lodge and board with me. The more learned he is, the more he would help. If you find someone, let me know. So I'm grateful to Candice Delisle for finding this passage in the printed correspondence of Gessner. Of course, Gessner is dead by then, 1577. One of my projects is also to look at Erasmus's printed letters which he edited, and whether he edits out any references to helpers, because this could be considered embarrassing. So thanks to serve the prestige of the author given the rank and reputation of those thanked, or they serve to boost young people being thanked, often relatives of the author. Finally, to encourage readers and other correspondents to contribute in the knowledge that they too would be recognized in due course if they did. Some of this thanking may also be a way of diffusing responsibility, showing that there's a form of peer review at work, a community of scholars approving and contributing to the work. And this seems a little reminiscent of the what literary scholars see as the fictive communities, the groups of shepherds, unnamed friends, enthusiastic editors, which are cited as support systems for authors' labors, in nicely put by Colin Burrow in a recent article. So is this comparable to what's going on with his play? I heard a nice talk by Jonathan Olson of Liverpool at Sharp about this. The first time I've seen other gentlemen, his friends, being listed on the title page, which is a way, of course, presumably, of not taking sole responsibility for printing as part of the stigma of print, part of the, you know, let us make sure that our friends have asked us to do this, et cetera. So I would argue that invoking the approval of others is a strategy to diffuse responsibility and avoid the risk of dishonor. On the other hand, there are other strategies, which perhaps we might attribute to printers more, surrounding, I'd say, brand naming, which might be designed to maximize profit. You boost sales by emphasizing a best-selling author. Calipino and Erasmus are fine examples of that, regardless of who does the work. On the other hand, when the work gets reprinted, you also have to argue that the new edition is new and better than the previous one. So then you have to add in new names or make new claims about it. So the Calipino Dictionary, here are some reference books that I would say acquire a brand of some kind. You can see they're pretty long running. And of course, this is the source base for my Too Much to Know. So the Calipino Dictionary, I only have one image, was the genuine bestseller of reference works, using Ian Green's standard here, one edition per year for 10 or more years, 185 editions over 200 years. And this is really a brand name. No other name than Calipino appears on the title page. Adrien Bayet, writing in his Jugement des Savants in 1685, commented, "The Calipino was nothing when it started. It was a pitiable work that left the hands of Ambrogio Calipino. Nonetheless, skilled people who saw that one could make something good from this project took the pains to purge it of errors, to put it in order, to augment it to the point where we see it today. So that today there's almost nothing left but the name and the title of the book that are by Calipino." So there, that's branding. With Mirabelli's Polyantea, which goes through 50 editions in just under 200 years, that would be a steady seller in Ian Green's terms, a minimum average of 5 editions in 30 years. The Polyantea started as an expansion of a medieval text, the Manipulus Florum. Nanni Mirabelli added a whole range of classical sentenciae, plus Dante and Petrarch, so it was much longer. And you can see its DNM is Domenico Nanni Mirabelli of Alba, who's credited as a title page. Very unusual to have such a nice a frontispiece at all on a reference book. That's dropped. Now we're moving through a few editions. You can see that this edition boasts that it contains translations of the Dante and Petrarch, which had been in Italian. Then we move to Collinus, the guy who was thanking M. Petrus Linnaeus. Now he on the title page, I want to emphasize how he's boasting that you are getting two books for the price of one, because you're getting not only Mirabelli, but also Franciscus Bartolomeus Amantius. And you notice the timing. Collinus produces three editions at about 10-year intervals, which is precisely when the privilege for each edition lasts. And the next Collinus includes the material from one Franciscus Tortius, though I haven't been able to identify him or any work by him. And you do have a little suspicion, is this an invention to make it look like, you know, there's some authority to the new stuff being added in here? Then we have an anonymous of Lyon who's credited. And finally, Joseph Lange comes along and he has reorganized it. He calls it a Nova Polyantea. He's made it much longer in addition. And then by the end, we have, and you see it's cumulative. So once you get on the title page, once you stay there, we have Mirabelli, Amantius, Tortius, Lange, and now we have Francisco Silvius, who adds the letters K, X, and Y, fleshing out that alphabet. So it's a brand on the one hand, and on the other hand, it's good to have that little bit more. After all, there is a used book market. We don't know that much about it, but this would be one of the selling points. Presumably, you're not going to buy a whole new book, but maybe if you're choosing between buying a used old one or a new one, you might be swayed to buy a new one. The Theatrum is doing something very similar. I mentioned how Zwinger's stepfather had given him slips. We saw his hand on them, and he credits that in the first edition of the Theatrum from Conrad Lycosthenes. Then he drops Lycosthenes, and of course, by now, this is the edition right after Zwinger's death. Jacob Zwinger, his son, has added an index, and he ends up on the title page. There we go. And then we have the massive expansion by the Catholic Laurentius Bayerlink, who, being Catholic, can't name them, but nonetheless, inside the book, he talks about the five people who built this work. He talks about the first, who laid the foundations, the second, who erected and formed the building, the third, who did not add anything but polished it, and the fourth and the fifth added the last touches and the colophon. That's himself and his printer. So no names are named, but we can see Conrad Lycosthenes, Theodor Zwinger, Jakob Zwinger. So that's one form of a branding. Here's another just example of a dictionary, which really gives you the started by, continued by, completed by, and names and specific dates. Another kind of branding, which Nick Nakin has studied in a recent Princeton dissertation around the Jerome, famously printed by Froben under Erasmus's name. You can see there's only one name on that title page. Erasmus came very late to this project, which was already underway at the Froben print shop, and Beatus Renanus probably did the bulk of the work. But once Erasmus, who's a best-selling author, you know, you can put his name on it, everything else fades away. Now, it's not clear that this is Erasmus's wish. Erasmus spends a lot of time thanking people, certainly in his letters, also in prefatory material in the book, and it's probably the decision of a printer who, as Joseph Lowenstein has emphasized, played a key role in promoting that ideology of authorship, especially when you have yourself the name of an author that sells things, like Erasmus. And similarly, at the other end of the time frame, Robert de Maria has also pointed out that Samuel Johnson's Dictionary of the English Language was marketed under his name alone, with no name mention of the various men who worked on it. There were 6 to 8 at various times for many years. Even though Johnson's kindness to his amanuenses is celebrated by Boswell, and as it's interesting to think about when it is that the great man is praised for being good to his servants. Certainly this is a trope for Boswell, but it probably isn't just an idealization, because we also have a letter from Samuel Johnson to Mrs. Thrail in which he frets about two of them, saying, "Peyton and McBean are both starving, and I cannot help them." So there too, the interpretation of De Maria is that it's the publisher who is putting pressure on the single name, who wants just to be sailing out under Samuel Johnson's name alone. So I've talked so far about the favorable uses of print, praising people, giving them credit, and so forth. Print was also used to criticize, and the stakes were all the higher for the diffusion it promised across time and space. When Henri Estienne used a printed preface to complain about the scholarly inadequacy of his son Paul, as John Considine has pointed out, one wonders about the impact on the relationship. It turns out Henri Estienne was a real grump, and he even disapproved of his daughter marrying young Casaubon, which seems very unfair. She was carrying on the habitus as instructed. We've seen, of course, repeatedly amanuenses making an appearance in print in order to be blamed for problems, for errors, or excessive prolixity. Not surprisingly, then, amanuenses aren't named, because that would really be invidious. You're offloading responsibility for bad things on them. Obviously, you shouldn't be naming them. And when they aren't named, then there's little loss of honor to anyone in specific, and there's plenty of honor to the new edition, which says that it's been purged from the errors of the amanuenses. So it's an opportunity to boast without anybody losing face. I have found one unique piece of back matter, actually, an amanuensis to the reader at the back of this large antiquarian collection of medieval manuscripts in print, with the principal investigators, which are John Selden and Roger Twisden, who get an ad lectorem. But at the back, we get one Radolf Jennings. Sadly, I still haven't found anything about him. But he's basically deflecting blame. He's saying ahead of time about all the great things he did. He worked right for the manuscripts. He went to the press. He selected the font. He closely examined each sheet. And of course, he is probably the head copyist of a job that must have required a whole slew of others. So every time someone's named, you know someone's being hidden as well. So when authors enter a world of what they considered undignified writing, they would use a helper as an agent of ventriloquy. So in these cases, the name on the title page is not a subset of the people actually involved in the work, which has been the norm so far. Instead, the name on the title page is just not the person who composed the work for a variety of reasons. So this can happen for a variety of reasons, to boost the honor of someone else as part of an economic arrangement or not, or as a strategy to preserve authorial honor. So just as Ramus used Talon's name to reply to Turneb, it was noble for Talon, after all, to come to the defense of a friend, but it was not seemly, as far as Ramus was concerned, to engage directly in disputes with a colleague. Of course, in other circumstances, people do directly engage with others, and I'm not clear on explaining why they choose the ventriloquy strategy versus the straight-on strategy. It needs more work. So leading responding to enemies to helpers is a strategy explicitly recommended to Erasmus by one of his correspondents, Johannes Cochleus, who was himself an expert polemicist against Lutherans. And he wrote to Erasmus in March 1529, who was smarting at the time from some recent attacks by Eppendorf, "I beg of you, do not reply to such mediocre enemies. What can they do to you? Your glory is long since so universal that the most learned men could not dim it. You have in your house many servants and secretaries perfectly capable of defending your honor against attackers of that ilk, without your even wasting 1 hour on them. It isn't seemly that you should stoop to cross swords with young men who seek to illustrate themselves at your expense. Your Corinus Talesius, the guy who got 150 crown gift, can set them straight prettily. Or, if you'd rather, we could publish something under the name of your cook to defend your honor and to condemn them to splendid ridicule." Right, so they're strategizing about, don't write back as Erasmus in any case, and he didn't. I'm not aware that they published anything under his cook's name either, or under Talesius' name. Now here, this is the mode used in this one French literary spat between the poet Clément Marot, who moved in court circles as écrivain to Anne of Brittany, and a priest and aspiring poet, but obviously much lesser, François Sagan, and I want you to see the spelling of their names, whose best line was to mock Marot for imitating Marot, as in Publius Virgilius Marot. So Marot's reply was couched as a pamphlet, "The Valet of Marot against Sagan," and Sagan replies in turn with more puns, calling the guy's valet Fripolippe, and so forth. So we can see how it gets pretty lowbrow, but of course it's all under pseudonyms and so forth. Yeah. My next example takes me back to Jean Bodin, who uses the figure not of a valet, but of his printer and then a fictitious character of a friend to rebut attacks against his République, published in 1576 in French. The stakes were high. Bodin was at the height of his modest political career, went downhill after that, but he was hoping to get an appointment at court. And the Genevois published an illicit imprint, an illicit publication of the République in 1577, and were trying to draw lessons from the République that favored overthrowing the monarchy. This is dangerous stuff, and Bodin has to reply. How does he do so? Bodin and his printer Dupuis take action immediately after the Geneva edition by publishing a République edition authorized in Paris in 1578, with some expanded front matter. In particular, this is a work entirely in French, Bodin adds a Latin epistola. The anomaly of this intruding Latin letter is explained in the piece of front matter immediately following, which is the Avis au lecteur by Dupuis the printer, who rails against the unauthorized Geneva edition, telling them, you know, it's undercutting his legitimate business, and, you know, the guy's a son of a cobbler anyways, he's a no good printer, etc. Just insult after insult. And he explains that he's included a Latin epistle that Bodin sent to Monsieur Pibrac, the dedicatee of the work, which I recovered by an intermediary, as if surreptitiously, to erase the opinion that those Geneva boasters have tried to impress on your brain. So what is in the Latin epistola? In the Latin epistola, Bodin takes issue with a learned argument of another jurist, Cujas, in a very measured and scholarly tone, and he congratulates the dedicatee. In other words, Bodin is floating up there being a Republic of Letters author, and Dupuis is busy, you know, cudgeling the nasty Genevois. Obviously, this is not Dupuis is claiming to have this behind Bodin's back, but that's not at all what happened. Bodin went on to print endlessly with Dupuis. So it's clearly a double strategy of a French invective on the one hand and the learned Latin bit on the other, even though it's completely out of place in a French book. In 1581, as the République has attracted more criticism, Bodin needs to reply. He composes an apologie, which will appear in 88 pages in every subsequent edition of the République. And it has that similar one-two punch of a Latin invective, a French invective with a Latin stance of scholarly neutrality and detachment from all this controversy. How he does it is by creating a fictitious friend and compatriot named René Herpin, who reproduces a Latin letter which Baudin had supposedly written to him, in which Baudin explains that he will not reply to his critics because the contentious type of writing is hardly praiseworthy, is often abused. Why not bear patiently the just reprehension of friends or foes instead? And then, of course, Herpin spends 88 pages, lambasting, talking about how it's hard for an author to defend himself when honor is at stake, without saying things which one cannot say without blushing with shame, since we treat honor differently from the ancients. So I think what he's saying is you can't be a modest, good Christian author and boast and reply to your critics properly. You need someone else to do it for you, and that's what René Herpin has done. And interestingly, the English translator of the work 40 years later was completely taken in, and he talks about Herpin as a person and about the wise words of Baudin that he quotes. It's not until the late 17th century that Plaquius' Dictionary of Pseudonyms mentions that Herpin is Baudin. So the lies on the title pages do seem to be effective among contemporaries, even though they're the ones who should know most about them, because they probably realize that it's happening too. So I have some other cases of ventriloquy using the character of helpers, because, of course, the friend is a neighboring category, not the same. An interesting 2008 Michigan dissertation by Michelle Miller has studied memoirs supposedly penned by noblemen in the late 16th and early 17th century France, penned by secretaries of noblemen to say things they couldn't say themselves. So, for example, Henry IV's chief minister, Maximilien Béthune de Sully, fell from power at the death of the king by assassination in 1610. 1611, he sets to work on his memoirs, which were only published 30 years later, but nonetheless, the text starts as a bid to get back into favor at court. It's written from the voice of his servant, who addresses the master throughout as vous. It includes nice details about his daily life to induce sympathy. It includes criticisms of Sully's earlier policies, which Sully could not easily have voiced himself, but would show him to be, amenable to adapting to new circumstances. And Michelle Miller has studied the manuscript of the work, which shows that Sully was active in annotating the text, which he likely had dictated in the first place, given the many oral mistakes in the text. So I don't have a picture, but I do have the Bibliothèque Nationale catalog entry, and you can see the amazing location of publication in Amsterdam from Alessinos Graf and Grafexicon. And basically, this is a self-published book, right? It says, i.e., chez l'auteur. Marie-Claude Felton has been studying books that actually say published chez l'auteur as an 18th century phenomenon, which was illegal until 1777 and then really took off. But I think this is a fascinating example of much earlier, which of course it isn't explicitly saying chez l'auteur, but I'm sure that catalog assessment is very plausible. So just to conclude, we have a few other cases I can tell you about of authentic ghostwriting, where someone is paid to write for someone else. That paid author then, of course, effaces himself. There's a very nice book by Grégoire Holtz on Louis Bergeron, who was the go-to man for travel narratives. And he worked with sea captains with their notes or straight from oral delivery to create narratives that conform to the norm of the genre at the time. And he completely effaces himself, but he has a huge impact on the text, introducing learned references, changing the opinions of the guy when he didn't think that they were appropriate, and carrying on. We've talked already about the ghostwriting of someone who effaces himself in order to give credit to someone of greater standing, so how Campano did that with the commentaries of Pius II. In the same Catholic world, there's also the case of Baronio, who attributes his 12-volume ecclesiastical history to his spiritual father, Neri, whom he calls the work's prime author and architect, even though he, Baronio, probably did all the work. So that's the kind of homage paid to a greater person. There is a reverse homage, which is Jean Baudin, who wrote a work under the name of his son, Elias Baudin, a collection of sentences in French and Latin of the kind that a child would use. Nothing came of Elias Baudin. Baudin probably hoped to get a jump start on his son's learned career, but that didn't happen. So a final thing I want to end with is Franck Lestringant's case of the ghostwriter who is angry, and that is Mathurin Erre, who had already been published translations of Darius Phrygius and of the Problems of Alexander of Aphrodisias, and who was basically the principal author of Les Singularités de la France Antarctique, which tell the story of André Thévée's going to the short-lived Huguenot colony in Brazil, except that Thévée was actually there, but he never got out of bed because he was sick the whole time. So Erre is basically composing this. He sued Thévée. He partly won the battle. He wanted money and he wanted credit, like his name on the title page. He didn't get credit. He did get financial compensation. And what he got to do was to lard the book with little puffs to his own works. And he even used as the first person to talk about his own experiences, things that never happened to Thévée. So someone in the know would realize who had written the book, in fact. So amanuenses knew things that were to be kept private. Interestingly, I can't find any kiss and tell books. The closest I've come is the reminiscences that Apollinaris, who became the great Basel printer, wrote in a letter to Jean Vire of his experience working for Paracelsus as a young man. And on his deathbed, Apollinaris apparently had listed this as one of the two things he regretted in his life, was having spoken ill of Paracelsus. He was a drunk, but even when drunk, he could dictate to me from his philosophy in such good, coherent fashion that the most sober person couldn't have done it better. An amazing skill. He never undressed at night. He would hit the walls and floors, and more than once I feared he would hit my head off. He always had his coal fire burning and would brew things. Once he had me look at the spirit brewing in his alembic, and the vapor overcame me, and it took a lot of cold water to bring me around. He behaved as if he could tell the future and foretold secret things, so I feared him and did not undertake anything secret. And finally, he notes that he had a great memory and could cite passages of Galen effortlessly. But when Apollinaris had translated from German and copied something he didn't understand in dictation and lecture and asked Paracelsus about it, Theophrastus explained everything as right. And Apollinaris got the suspicion, this is told in the third person who's reusing his letter, got the suspicion from his rapid agreement that a lot of it was only empty talk. So we're grateful to him for the breach of early modern etiquette in dishonoring a dead man. Of course, it was long after his death. But it's interesting that Apollinaris still felt that pang of guilt years later. Obviously, he didn't realize, he said, that the letter would be used to print from. The letter's now lost, so it's only because it was printed from that we know about it. To try and conclude, Howard Becker in Art Worlds asks, why do these things matter about who did what? The work, after all, doesn't change if we learn that someone else did it. But, he says, who writes the words and when they're written affect our judgment of what the work is made of, what it reveals about the person who made it. Not all early modern scholars work with others. I've not found any sign of amanuensis yet for Descartes, for example, though he consulted lens grinders and other specialists. Robert Burton also complained of having had no help in composing his Anatomy of Melancholy. But I'm pleasantly surprised that by looking for them, we can find many helpers, though we have lost track of many more, no doubt. And I hope that tracking the visibility and invisibility of helpers in manuscript, iconographic formats, and print, amanuenses can give us some more contextual fodder from which to interpret the intricacies of the claims made in manuscript and in print by authors and printers who are, as Roger Chartier and Peter Stalybras remind us in their recent What is a Book article, their conveniences created by the printing of books. And after all, to use a quotation that I owe to my stepmother, and this is a kind of helper not yet mentioned, Jerusha McCormick, a retired academic, and speaking about a very unusual writer who wrote in seclusion, but who perceived herself as an amanuensis to higher voices, but ought not the amanuensis to receive a commission also. So thanks so much. I look forward to your comments and questions.
Thank you for our fascinating series of lectures. I would like just to get back to the discussion of the acknowledgements kind of genre. I think I was quoted in the letter preface to the Book of Natural History by Conrad Gesner, some mention of what I would call correspondence, I mean, acknowledging correspondence, people who have sent the information. I was wondering whether you've come across these kind of acknowledgments in either this genre or elsewhere. And I would just to ask you one more question about what that kind of crossing the confessionalization divide, whether you've again come across even subtle acknowledgement of Catholic or Protestant authors that reprint, re-edit, rework the work of somebody from Morocco.
Yeah, that's a very nice question. Thank you. I think certainly Protestants use Catholic stuff. If they didn't, there wouldn't be much to read when they get started. Obviously, Catholics have a bit harder time using Protestant material, but as we know, they do through expurgation, through getting permission to use it. So Aldrovandi owned a copy of Zwinger's Theatrum, and you know, with permission. And he says per legi, so he read it thoroughly. That's a very good point about, so certainly the Republic of Letters is corresponding across those confessional divides, and the standard line about the Republic of Letters is that it tries to transcend them and that people thought of themselves as transcending those divides. It's true that Ian MacLean has recent work showing, in particular around publication, how printers might actually, you know, get in a dig and transform a work to the confession that matches the printer, but which the author might not have approved of if they'd realized what was going on. So it's not always as smoothly interconfessional as it's made out to be. But nonetheless, I think, you know, especially among these natural historians, this is correspondence is happening across confessional lines. It's a good question about that list. We should look back and try and see, we could do that, but try and see, you know, exactly if there are, of course, that's a Protestant, so I'm sure he doesn't have any problem listing Catholics. To get Aldrovandi doing the same, so certainly I found it with Gessner. I think Münster, I'm not sure he names people by name. I don't know about Fuchs. Gessner is a particularly, you know, he's just a compiler who realizes, you know, starting off by calling his dictionary by my friends, it's just, so he may be unique that way to some extent, but obviously there's a lot of thanking that's going on privately through letters and stuff. That was a great question. Thank you.
Next question.
So thank you. That was spectacular. two questions. One is about the wonderful colophon you showed with the names of the correctors. And presumably right. That's what that actually means.
Right. Although they, yeah.
I think that's what it's.
Even in the print shop, you're saying. Yeah, mm-hmm. Good point.
They would have read the copy and they would have, that's what he's thanking them for.
Right.
So the question is, how often do you find that? Because it seems to me it's oddly rare in the Latin and Western language traditions, though very common in Hebrew and Yiddish.
To mention the corrector, you mean?
That difference happens because Yiddish colophons are full of the names of the correctors and even the compositors.
Interesting.
Have you run into others?
No, absolutely. Well, you're the expert on this. Yeah, for sure.
I've never found just the one where the corrector blames the Ethiopian for making it
wrong. Right. As you say, in dire scandals, then you might hear about it. Maybe given in the Yiddish and the Hebrew, obviously the difficulty of that might warrant, because here it's the mathematical nature. It is true that's praised about everybody, that they did a good job on it, you know.
Yiddish, it's often teenage girls.
Yeah. Right.
I'm sorry
okay.
for making these mistakes. I'm just going to do a little rhyme, you know, I'm just a kid. So I'm not sure it's so hard.
No, yeah.
So the other question is mathematics a special case?
Right.
Because the making of tables and
yes.
things of that kind seems to me to be somewhat different from the production of other kinds of text.
Right.
Have you found other cases, or has the gentleman at Notre Dame found other cases for this in the mathematical?
That's a very good question. I mean, what comes to mind is the idea that calculation is a mechanical process, just like we talked about how copying is supposed to be mechanical. That Rainy Dastin has good stuff on that, but that's, of course, later for the 18th century. Right, because of the difficulty. And that's part of creating I'm reminded of Nathaniel Bowditch and the whole problem of whether you use tables to navigate by. I mean, these tables had better be right if you're going to really use them. And therefore, citing the names of the people who corrected the tables is part of promising a quality product, I suppose.
But it's also just a manufacturer. I mean, Erasmus Runholt has letters to his patron saying, I've got a cellar full of boys doing the computation, I need to feed them.
Right.
And I wonder if that's probably not a normal case for these huge,
right.
huge data-driven models.
Of course, Tycho Brahe would be another example, perhaps, of someone who That's a great point, yeah. I have, so far, I sort of focused on amanuenses doing things that the master could do. But of course, another thing they do is stuff that the guy can't do because they're a foreign language and drawing, and then this would be a prime example. You're absolutely right. Thank you.
Thank you. So illuminating. I'm always wondering, you know, there's been some literature about the idea of the experience of friendship during the Enlightenment, and how the constitution of Republic of Letters is kind of friends and equals.
Right.
And the rhetoric of equality that enters it.
Please speak up a bit. I'll give you a back.
I'm sort of thinking while I'm talking. Sorry. Speak tall. So what I'm trying to ask is the question about the rhetoric of friendship and helpers. Mm-hmm. That is friendship ever actually achieved with respect to a helper? You have a whole range of types of helpers. You have paid and unpaid. Mm-hmm. So that's a contractual or non-contractual arrangement. You have familial and non-familial. You have servants and you have colleagues, if you will. You have correspondents. But what does friendship mean in these texts that you've shown us in relationship to this emerging, I want to think of it as a humanist idea of equality, but it doesn't seem to be present here. So I just wondered on the tension between helpers and friends.
Thank you. That's a great question. The language of affection is certainly present, amanuensis to Erasmus, say, cousin. You know, even when cousin has just left and basically slammed the door and won't go back, he talks about how he misses Erasmus, how he hopes he'll remember him as a most faithful servant. So there's the, but as you say, that's not friendship. So affection is, that is the main language. Remember that they're being paid principally by gifts, which is also a sign of affection. So nothing is sort of, the contract aspect is pretty weak. So it's important to keep that patina. And even when Erasmus doesn't like someone, clearly, you know, he keeps them in his employ, and he's obviously not saying that to their face. He's bad-mouthing someone, often not by naming them, in fact, to Amerbach and so on. So what is a friend? Friends hold all things in common.
Indeed, what is a
friend? It's someone who, obviously, who helps, who doesn't have his own agendas in helping you, I suppose, would be one way of perhaps. I mean, they're fictive friends, so those are the best friends, clearly. Friends you've invented. Erpin is one of them, and the quidam amicus noster, you know. Yeah, true friends.
Dead friends, like Lavoisier.
Right, yeah, dead ones, yeah. Yes, like Omer Talon. Yeah, absolutely right. Thanks.
Peter. I wanted to ask about how the relationship between helpers and authors is different in a situation where, by and large, I mean, as far as I can make out in the 17th century, I've tried to work out how much authors were paid. And virtually no one's paid.
Right.
Well, it's very abnormal to pay. 20 books is very typical.
Right.
You know, and the people who do get paid are almanac makers or compilers. They get paid. Translators often get paid. And editors get paid. And so in legal books and things like that, you actually see quite a lot of significant money. So you have a bizarre reversal of what you might expect, that the author at that level is bottom of the totem pole in terms of... And so Erasmus is very much an exception, because obviously can throw a huge range of ways, leverage his name. And that seems to be a very major... I mean, Jim Green and I worked on that a little bit. Jim can say more than I can about that. But in America, like in the 18th century, you find virtually no one. Is that true, Jim, making any significant money? Again, it's almanac makers, you know, so it's the compiler who actually can make money and also often actually establish one of these permanent names. So an almanac, you know, even if it's a pseudonym, you know, you pour into it or something, can long live after the death of the almanac maker. So it becomes, we used to
call the brand name kind of thing. Yep.
That's right. But just the main thing is to say that helpers in certain ways are actually being financially rewarded in ways that what we now consider primary authors are not being rewarded.
And that's because credit is what the author is getting. And we can see that very much with Fougerolles and Erre. It's, you know, either credit or money. And if you're not getting credit, you get money. Or control or ability to, you know, insert yourself in the book. Thank you.
I just want to point out there's a comparable situation with book packaging today, where book packagers get money for producing books, but the authors, the authorship, very hard to find out and put them together.
Thank you.
John.
Just a quick on that, because I was thinking of it before Peter asked this question on the Almanac issue. It does remind me in a sort of downmarket case that Poor Richard's Almanacs, there's, you know, we don't know, Franklin is invisible, but Theophilus Grew, who makes, does the tables, is actually credited year after year. Jim, am I right about that? So that's a case where the,
right.
And you could call that credit or you could call that money, but right. Maybe it's both.
And it's got that technical angle too, the mathematical.
Right, he's certainly doing the technicals.
Right.
In there.
Very nice. Thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
I have two questions. One is about the printer's calculus. You mentioned that it might be in the printer's interest to suppress mm-hmm. other authors' names, go with Erasmus and mm-hmm. so on, but of course Erasmus isn't around forever.
Right.
So at what point does it become in the printer's interest to create new
yes.
Superstars and how
that's a great point.
Figure out when they're making that.
In fact, Erasmus has a letter to Froben saying, I'm not going to live forever, and you better, you know, find yourself another option, because Erasmus is publishing with someone else, and basically Froben never comes up with an alternative. I mean, there's no one's going to beat Erasmus. He was incredible. And how Froben ended up with Erasmus was kind of luck, I suppose, you know. So I suppose it lands on you and you take advantage of it and then it dries up and, you know, you go back to being an average Basel printer. Whereas because of his association with Erasmus, he was propelled to, you know, the greatest heights. So in other words, I don't know that Froben really, the way Alexander von Outgaerden portrays Froben is very much a creation of Erasmus, in fact, and he argues convincingly, I think, that Erasmus wrote a lot of that printer to the reader was, and so Froben was, you know, wasn't up to strategizing, really. You know, he didn't create Erasmus. Obviously, he did decide to, you know, say to put, to eliminate some names from it, but Erasmus came to him. Of course, he was seeking to duplicate what he'd had with Aldus.
And there, Erasmus clearly strategizes. We have the letter.
Yes.
Aldus,
yes.
Typography.
And he kind of miscues it, right? He offers to write a preface for Aldus to appear in the book, and Aldus is like, you know, Aldus writes his own prefaces. Don't need no help from you, young man.
Question here.
Is that both your questions?
Well, I had another one.
Okay.
Sorry, go ahead.
I also have a short question about the culture of the private, because I'm a publish ancient Chinese text, and in the Latin pre-modern Chinese text, we don't really have the authorship, they also don't really want to put their real name on that. They usually read as a song.
Right.
Or literature social, they wrote a lot of commentaries, but they like the name as anonymous, or mm-hmm. somebody living among them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of very different idea of the credit. So do you plan to expand more? Why everybody want to be famous?
That's a good question. Right. Good. I'll repeat the question so that people can understand it. So in China, people don't seek to get their name on title pages, or authors don't seem to want their name in the highlights. And so why do European authors care about being famous? And I think, you know, Horace writes in whatever it was, I have made a monument to outlast the pyramids of Egypt. They want, and that's a model that the humanists are looking right at. I don't know why Horace got that idea, but, and of course he has done quite well for himself, and I don't know how many... I don't know how many other guys there were with the same ambition who also wrote about that who we don't know about at all. It's possible that, you know, Horace is one of many who built monuments to outlast the pyramids of Egypt. But anyways, he did make it, and of course the humanists are highly aware of that. And print is going to be this method. We'll never again have the loss of knowledge that we had, the loss of learning that we had in coming down from antiquity, because now we have printing. And what we also need is libraries. Good thing to be known. Printing plus libraries equals no loss of knowledge ever. That's the vision of Gessner, for example? So that's a great question. Honor, of course, and what honor means, I like the idea that Baudin talks about how honor is different from with the ancients. I think the ancients were perceived to be very much into boasting and you know, just me. And these Christian, you know, humanists have that tendency, and on the other hand, they've got to be humble and they've got to realize, you know, you can't have divine inspiration. They are in a little bit more of a bind about, but of course, it's a given that fame is one of their main goals, I think. Not all of them. Obviously, you don't have to publish, and that would be the case of, I suppose, some of those courtly poets who went for reputation at a time and cared about their personal relations and not about their legacy. But most of these people, I think, are trying to, yes, palliate the the fear of death, or, you know, the impact of death.
I have a question there. Next to you, your question. You have a question? Go ahead.
I was just going to respond to the young lady from China. If you've read Zhuangzi and some of the other earlier philosophers, you know that their style of writing was much more communal and in response to each other, and it was kind of a version of bringing their oral argument to paper. So I think maybe some of the difference there is there's an assumption of your audience knowing who you are and being involved in the discourse, whereas maybe, and I'm not schooled at all in Western Buddhism, I'm much more schooled in Asian Buddhism, but I think that this need for being able to sell books or to sell manuscripts based on recognition is lessened in China, especially in modern China, because everyone that was someone was reading these texts because it was part of the philosophical tradition of learning and sharing communal knowledge. So I think the idea of onomasis is very interesting because in China, everyone's an onomas to one another in developing an intellectual history that's very communal in a way that's very different from the West. So maybe that's why, I'm not sure. And also the tradition of printing and how things were distributed are different in China as well.
Second question?
Oh, sure. So I've been working on a dispute that a Spanish theologian, historian Juan de Mariana, enters into early 17th century. Essentially, he's attacked by a young humanist who turns out to be the secretary and librarian of a nobleman in Naples, whom Mariana had ridiculed in an earlier publication. And when this secretary librarian publishes attack on Mariana's history of Spain, he essentially says, you're probably going to doubt me, or doubt the my authorship, because of course everyone may see a motive for doing this, mm-hmm. but I assure you that I wrote this on my own volition because I happen to find these errors in your text. And so I'm wondering, is that
that's the ultimate
a full mastery of this code of having your friend, or is this sort of amateurism? I don't know how this code works. Are you supposed to play by the code or by acknowledging it openly up front? Is this?
I think that looks like mastery to me. I would think, I would think, especially when it's about, you know, getting into invective and so on. That's great. I'd love that reference. Thank you.
We have time for a couple more questions.
There's one over. There's one over there.
I was just struck by parallels to you mentioned in an earlier lecture movie credits, which now are as long as the movies. But there are conventions, for instance, when people want to remove them, dissociate themselves from what has happened to a film. Screenwriters, I'm sure people here know that better. There's a name that conventionally gets used when a screenwriter decides they do not want to be credited because of what's happened to the screenplay. So there's some pseudonym that typically gets used. Are you aware of any similar devices for disclaiming credit in any of them?
That's a great question. Well, of course, you can. You would say that someone wrote it in your stead or it was unauthorized. I mean, that would be the classic. It's usually something you do first. If you, you know, go out saying this is yours and so forth, that's why you would float something first and not say, claim credit until you see that the trial balloons come out pretty well. Then it's like, oh, yeah, sure, that's my work. Otherwise, you know, that's the timidity. Once it's out, I haven't seen someone try to reverse it. Oh, that was a terrible mistake, or let's recall that email message. Yeah, thank you. That's a great question.
Pierre Marteau, you know, the anonymous printer that everybody can use to print their politically dangerous works. It's a little bit of a different case, but mm-hmm. Everybody can be that. Everybody can put Pierre Marteau on their title page.
Or
you'll never know
right.
who really printed it.
Right, or any other of those fanciful, yeah. But it's a decision you have to make first. I mean, it's very hard to, I would think, to backtrack after the fact.
The parallel would be the soft release, which is more and more common for software things, for
example. Yes.
The soft, it's like the soft,
soft release.
Yes.
A beta version or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you get feedback, and yeah.
But if splendid. There, you do want the credit.
Yes, and the money at some point, probably.
Right, wonderful. There, and then we'll have a last question if there is one.
My question is sort of a longer-term question, and it's also, I guess it's about all three lectures. One of the themes that was sort of present there, but it was really movement, was that as time goes along, in some sense, helpers become a little more invisible, and as they become less important in some sense, at least in this context of scholarship. And I do modern stuff, so I think about modern things. And one of the sort of places of collective scholarly work that arises, you know, in the 17th century are academies and things like that. So institutions that in some sense often play up the importance of collective work and in some sense making themselves. It talks very much about the importance of collective work. And I'm wondering whether is it possible that one of the ways in which this sort of, with the way people think about their literary helpers in your context might be being at that later period being in some sense influenced by these new conceptions of what sort of research work might be in the collectivity.
No, thank you. That's a great question. I had a little section that sort of got lopped off about social books, you know, this category that comes in the late 17th century in the eyes of Placius, which are these collectively authored books like the King James Bible or the Quimber Commentaries or the Magdeburg Centuries, some of which, you know, they're written in different ways. It does seem to me that there's already an idea of collective work in operating, say, with Gessner and the Republic of Letters. So the academies are sort of a consequence of that rather than something completely new. But of course, and how they transform, of course, the academies have a hierarchy to them too. So there are the members, especially in France, and then there are, you know, the other guys, sort of they all have secretaries or helpers. And then there are corresponding members or lesser members somehow. So I'm not sure that it eliminates the hierarchy, in fact.
Hierarchy, yes.
Yep.
Collective could be.
But collective, hierarchy. Yes, I see what you're saying.
There's hierarchy on the website.
Right. So whether people have larger scale projects together maybe would be a question. So the way science becomes more big, say, right? They're more group, like the big expeditions, obviously, and journal production is sort of a multi-person operation. Whether scholarship, there are some large scholarship, you know, projects even in the Middle Ages too, in fact, probably, you know, obviously Biblical Concordance or Encyclopedia is a huge, the biggest kind of collaborative work, or is Eusebius and so on, and even the early Christian period. I don't know. I suppose I'm being difficult about coming up with a historical arc. I'm seeing, Tony, you want to, yeah.
There are some huge, the huge ones would be, for example, the Benedictines of Saint Maur,
mm-hmm.
800 full members of the order.
Mm-hmm. All working on it. Yeah.
In the production of the Sanctorum, the Biennales. And that's a huge, that's, I don't think there's any scientific work on
no.
that scale.
No. Thank you.
All right. Time for one last question. On that note, please.
Yeah. makes sense. But I want to have the last word, which is the last word. Thank you. Thank you all. It's been a tremendous week. And I really, I did express some doubts when I first accepted this this gig. And wow, I couldn't be more delighted with the great references, books I've seen, people I've met, and look forward to keeping in touch with. So thank you very much, all of you.